The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Dr. Scott Youngkin from the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Health Issues. For the next half hour, I'm going to be reading articles from the Mayo Clinic Health Letter and probably from the Harvard Health Letter. And I'm going to start with the Mayo Clinic Health Letter. This is from August, and it's an article entitled Second Opinion. My husband saw an ad about an at-home test that looks at what's in your gut and can predict if you'll get different diseases. Are these tests accurate? He's probably referring to gut microbiome tests, which in recent years have become more widely available to the public. These are separate and different from an at-home test screening for colon cancer. Mayo Clinic experts say that these types of direct-to-consumer microbiome tests may not be worth the cost. Despite recent advances, the impact of DTC microbiome tests is limited. They may not be as valuable as advertised for spotting health issues. For DTC stool tests, you collect a stool sample and mail it to the company. Laboratory technicians analyze the spectrum of microorganisms, including bacteria, fungi, and viruses that coexist, ideally peacefully and constructively in your body. This collection of microorganisms is known by several names, including the microbiota, the microflora, or the microbiome. The makeup of the microbiome is tied to a range of health benefits, including helping to digest food, regulating metabolism, and training the immune system. But there's one issue. Analyzing the microbiome is a developing area of research. Even though there is vastly more known now than even a decade ago, there's still more to learn about how the microorganisms in the gut shape a person's health. Further, the microbiome varies. What's healthy in one person may not be the same in another due to genetics, lifestyle, diet, and other factors. In addition, mailing the sample may not be the best, as obtaining the most accurate results involves fairly immediate processing. Researchers at the Mayo Clinic recently developed a lab test of the gut microbiome that returns a so-called credit score for your gut, called the Gut Microbiome Health Index. It analyzes the microbiome and assigns a score based on how similar or different the contents of your gut microbiome are to the microbiomes of thousands of people without chronic disease. As of today, the score alone can't diagnose or accurately predict your risk of chronic disease. But researchers are working to eventually develop GMHI. Remember, that's the Gut Microbiome Health Index, into a test that alerts you to an increased risk of disease and advises you on actionable lifestyle changes. Early results are promising, with more testing and development to follow. Question. I've been taking lorazepam, that's also called Ativan, for insomnia, but my doctor suggests that I taper off the drug. It seems to be the only thing that helps me sleep. Why do I need to quit? Because of natural changes in the body, insomnia and other sleep problems become common with age. Unfortunately, many medications used to treat these conditions are not appropriate for long-term use, especially in older adults. The drug lorazepam or Ativan is in a class of controlled substances called benzodiazepines. These drugs can sometimes treat short-term sleep issues, but long-term use is not recommended because of the risk of significant side effects. For older adults, these include coordination and balance issues, fatigue, drowsiness, and an increased risk of falls and fracture, as well as memory problems like trouble concentrating and forgetfulness. There's also the potential to become addicted to benzodiazepines, even when they're used as prescribed. Despite these risks, you should not quit a benzodiazepine suddenly. This can lead to severe and dangerous withdrawal symptoms. If you and your care provider decide it's time to stop taking lorazepam, work together to determine a reasonable schedule for tapering your medication. There are other prescription and non-prescription medications available to help with insomnia. Many of these options can have significant side effects, especially in older adults. It's essential to have a discussion with your provider before taking any insomnia medication. You might also discuss other sleep aids. For example, cognitive behavioral therapy for insomnia can improve sleep quality, shorten the time needed to fall asleep, and increase the time spent sleeping. Your provider may also suggest a sleep study to ensure that your sleep issues aren't caused by an underlying condition, like sleep apnea. And then one other article from the Mayo Clinic Health Letter of August. It's called Clinical Trials. Clinical trials are the process for evaluating new tests and treatments. During the COVID-19 pandemic, you probably heard a lot about clinical trials. It may have seemed like a real-life cliffhanger as the world waited on the results of scientific trials for vaccines to prevent the infection and for drugs to treat it. Clinical trials are carefully designed human experiments that evaluate the benefits and risks of a new test, treatment, or medication. Drugs, medical devices, and surgical procedures are all evaluated using clinical trials. Here are three things to know about how clinical trials work. First, there's a lot of preliminary work. Before drug treatments even get to the clinical trial stage, an enormous amount of preliminary work helps researchers to better understand a disease. This leads to targeted identification and selection of potential drug compounds. That process often comes down to one or two compounds with the desired characteristics. Then toxicity tests are done to identify potential harm. Only then is the treatment submitted to the FDA for review and approval to move into clinical trials. In a trial involving a drug, there are four distinct phases. Phase 1 generally involves fewer than 100 people. This phase helps to determine the best way to administer the drug, whether there are any unacceptable side effects, and the maximum tolerable dose. In Phase 2, the drug is given to a larger number of people, up to several hundred, and further evaluated for safety and effectiveness. Phase 3 is a much larger study. It involves hundreds to thousands of participants to evaluate whether a new treatment is better than the existing treatments. Phase 4 occurs after a drug receives FDA approval and is on the market. The drug is monitored for long-term safety and effectiveness in the general population. About 1 in 10 possible treatments that enter clinical trials actually make it through Phase 3 trials and through FDA regulatory approval. Another thing you need to know about clinical trials is that not everyone gets the treatment. Participating in a clinical trial doesn't necessarily mean you're going to receive the experimental treatment. For example, in a trial to measure the effectiveness of a new treatment, participants are randomly assigned to a group. A control group may receive a placebo. This is a harmless, inactive substance that looks like the drug being tested. An experimental group receives the new treatment. Most high-quality studies are blinded, which means masked studies. That means that participants don't know which group they're in. In a single-blind study, the participants don't know which treatment they're receiving. During a double-blind study, the participants and the study staff don't know whether the participant received the treatment or a placebo. Note that consent to participate in the trial must reveal whether there is a potential to receive a placebo. The third thing you need to know about clinical trials is that a process improvement is common. The urgency of the COVID-19 pandemic taught researchers new approaches to rapidly meet the severe global threat. One lesson, in times of crisis, the review process can be sped up, and bureaucracy can be minimized without losing scientific rigor and safety standards required of clinical trials. The ability to conduct trials of some drugs at hundreds of sites at the same time led to a more rapid recruitment of study participants and to a more rapid assessment of a drug's effectiveness and safety. Further, the process put additional focus on including people of different ages, races, and socioeconomic status in clinical trials. Historically, racial minorities have been underrepresented in clinical trials. Mayo Clinic and other medical centers are seeking to intentionally broaden the participant pool by partnering with organizations that serve diverse communities. Are you considering a clinical trial? Here's what you need to know. Clinical trials can change the practice of medicine. Deciding whether to take part in a clinical trial requires careful consideration. As part of the informed consent process, you should get clear and understandable answers to certain questions like, what's the purpose of the study? What will be required of you? How will your health be monitored throughout the study? What are the known risks and benefits of participating? How might the study benefit you or eventually benefit others? How will your personal health information be protected? Will all healthcare expenses related to the study be covered? Are there extra costs like travel, lodging, and parking that you're going to have to pay? The article goes on to mention that clinical trials can be searched for by looking at the National Library of Medicine Registry. That's at clinicaltrials.gov or at the National Cancer Institute Registry, which is at cancer.gov/about-cancer/treatment/clinical-trials. Now we're going to continue with the Mayo Clinic Health Letter of August 2022, and this is a special report entitled Life in the Balance: Restoring Steadiness, Preventing Falls, and Living Well. Balance problems are common. As people age, they tend to be less active and find their body gradually loses the fine balance skills of their youth. Are problems with balance taking a toll on you, physically, mentally, or emotionally? If you said yes, you're not alone. About 8 million American adults say they have an ongoing problem with balance. 2.5 million adults in the United States have chronic issues with dizziness. If you're afraid of falling, you may avoid situations that increase your risk. You may forego the activities of life that bring you meaning and joy. Balance disorders have physical effects too. If you worry about falling, you may move less. Moving less makes it more likely that you're going to lose muscle tone, muscle strength, and balance skills. Your posture may change, altering the way you move and making balance even more difficult. Balance and dizziness issues can be part of a vicious cycle, but with the right daily choices and types of activity, you can sidestep these negative mental, emotional, and physical effects. Your balance system allows you to remain upright as you walk and move around or change position. It helps keep your vision focused and clear while your head is turning. Good balance also keeps you aware of the position of your head in relation to the ground. To maintain your balance, your brain must coordinate sensory information from your eyes, your inner ear, the bottoms of your feet, the major joints like the ankles, knees, and neck. Using this information, the brain tells the muscles of your body how to react and maintain your position. This same information helps to form your perceptions of how you're oriented in space, what direction you're moving in, and how fast. Here's more on how your balance system works. Your eyes. No matter what position you're in, sitting, standing, lying down, or moving, visual signals help you to determine where your body is in space. When light hits your retina, it generates electrical impulses that are sent to your brain through the optic nerve. Your brain interprets these signals as images. It then uses the images to calculate spatial relationships. For example, how far your chair seat is above the ground, how far away a car is moving in front of you, or how fast you're moving relative to someone walking beside you. Millions of nerve cells or neurons are located in your skin, muscles, and joints. When touch, pressure, or movement stimulate these cells, they send electrical impulses to your brain about what your body is doing. For example, whether you're lying on a soft mattress or reaching up to a high cupboard shelf. Information about the movement of your neck and your ankles is especially important for balance. It tells your brain which way your head is turned and how steady you are on the ground. Next is the vestibular labyrinth. The vestibular labyrinth, located within each ear, is your primary balance organ. The brain uses this inner ear system to tell whether your head is, to tell where your head is relative to gravitational space, and whether your head or body is changing position. Although you're probably not as aware of the vestibular labyrinth as you are of your eyes, your brain relies on its input for balance. This is especially true when information from the eyes, joints, or feet is disrupted. Problems with dizziness and balance can arise anywhere within your sensory system. To maintain balance across a full range of daily activities, two of the system's elements must work well. For example, you likely won't lose your balance if you close your eyes while you're standing. Signals from your inner ear and musculoskeletal nerves keep you upright. But if your central nervous system can't process the signals properly, or if the vestibular labyrinth isn't functioning correctly, you may get dizzy and fall. Usually, you maintain your sense of balance without thinking about it, thanks to years of practice and healthy sensory input. But you've likely experienced a brief episode of dizziness in your life. Momentary dizziness is often caused by an abrupt and rapid change in the environment. You may feel momentarily dizzy when your brain becomes aware of unusual sensory input, like the first time on board a rocking boat. Another example is when you first get off a treadmill. It often takes a few seconds for you to adjust to the fact that your surroundings now move past you when you walk. Dizziness may also result from conflicting sensory information. For example, if you're sitting in a movie theater watching the shot of a landscape taken through the window of a train, your eyes will signal movement. At the same time, your muscles, nerves, and vestibular system tells you that you are stationary. As a result, you may briefly feel dizzy. Spinning or sudden movements also cause dizziness. When you stop moving, the fluid in your inner ear is still in motion. This is what makes you feel dizzy. When the fluid comes to rest, the dizziness generally goes away. Dizziness caused by environmental changes isn't serious, but sudden severe attacks or prolonged dizziness, faintness, or a feeling that your surroundings are spinning around can signal an underlying disorder. Common non-ear-related causes of balance and dizziness issues include low blood pressure, poor blood circulation, multiple sensory deficits including failing vision, nerve damage in the arms and legs, osteoarthritis, and muscle weakness. Problems with dizziness can also occur from anxiety disorders, as well as disorders of the central nervous system, including Parkinson's disease, multiple sclerosis, tumors, and stroke. It can occur from migraines and from reactions to certain medications. If your balance exam suggests that your symptoms are caused by a problem with your balance system, you may be diagnosed with an inner ear issue. The most common cause of vertigo is benign paroxysmal positional vertigo. With BPPV, sudden and severe spinning spells are triggered by a change in head position. This is very treatable. The article goes on to mention a sit-to-stand test. Many factors can make it less likely that you'll fall. One important factor is the strength in your legs. If you're not sure how strong your legs are, take a 30-second sit-to-stand test. Use a chair with a standard height, about 17 inches from the floor. Sit close to the front of the chair. Stand all the way up and sit down as many times as you can in 30 seconds. The more repetitions you can do, the lower the risk of falling. In general, physical therapists say that those who do fewer than 8 repetitions have a higher risk of falling. How many repetitions did you do? There is a chart that's attached that tells you how to compare your results against others. For example, men in the age group 65 to 69 should be able to do 12 to 18 repetitions in 30 seconds. If it's hard to stand up from a standard height chair, start your practice with a higher bed or stool, or try placing a pillow on the seat of the chair. As you practice, do each repetition as slowly as possible. The longer you take for each repetition, the more muscle strength you'll build in your legs. Now we're continuing this article about balance. And the article goes on to mention vertigo. Vertigo and other symptoms of vestibular disorders are most often treated with medications or through rehabilitation therapy. Rarely, surgery may be an option. The best option for you depends on the frequency and severity of your symptoms, the amount of hearing you've retained, and your overall health. Most of the time, vestibular problems aren't life-threatening, and your doctor can prescribe ways to manage the condition. The key is to work together with your healthcare team to find the best blend of therapies. You can start at home to manage your balance. The choices you make at home can either make falls more likely or less likely. First of all, you need to remove home hazards. Take a look around. Your living room, kitchen, bedroom, bathroom, hallways, and stairways may be filled with hazards. Secure loose rugs and place essentials within easy reach. Keep high traffic areas clear to walk through. Keep your home brightly lit to help navigate your way. If needed, ask your healthcare team about getting an occupational therapist's tips for reducing your fall risk at home. You can use assistive devices. If your doctor recommends using a cane or walker, ask whether a physical therapist can help you to choose the best device. Other assistive devices include handrails for both sides of stairways, non-slip treads for bare wood steps, raised toilet seats or one with armrests, grab bars for the shower or tub, a sturdy plastic seat for the shower, and a phone with pre-programmed speed dial for emergency contacts to have next to your bed. Also, it's important to wear sensible shoes. Change your footwear as part of your fall prevention plan. High heels, floppy slippers, or sandals, and shoes with slick soles can make it more likely that you're going to slip, stumble, and fall. So can walking in your stocking feet. Be sure your shoes are firmly attached to your feet, keeping your toes and heels in place. This provides a direct line of communication between your feet and your brain. Your brain tells the muscles in your feet what adjustments they need to make to keep you steady. Also, it's important to talk to your healthcare team about your medications. Make a list of all the prescription and non-prescription medications and supplements you take. Your care team can review your medications for side effects and interactions that may increase your risk of falling. Common culprits include blood pressure medications, sleep medications, antihistamines, certain antidepressants, and drugs used to control pain. Well, it looks like we've run out of time for today's episode of Health Issues. Be sure to listen next time. I sure hope you enjoyed it. I'm Dr. Scott Youngkin, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Health Issues is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. That's ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thanks for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service. Thank you.